Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, invasive species are wreaking havoc all over the world and costing hundreds of billions of dollars per year. Some regions are more successful than others in maintaining or restoring ecosystems with their indigenous species. How bad is the damage from invasive species and what can be done about it? And first, biodiversity is under extreme attack in the high seas, but there's a new treaty that seeks to protect it. We explore conservation, sustainability, and the marine biodiversity beyond national jurisdictions, or what's called BBNJ. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The world faces an environmental crisis of a mass extinction event. The loss of species and diversity within species has accelerated, and many scientists have asserted that we're in a sixth mass extinction event. A reminder, the fifth was the dinosaurs. In response, the nations of the world have negotiated treaties on biodiversity, but the Convention on Biodiversity only places obligations on states to protect species within their sovereign territories and waters. But roughly 70% of the world's surfaces are oceans. So protecting biodiversity needed to extend beyond those national jurisdictions and fell under the category of the law of the sea. So in June of this year, 2023, nearly 200 countries adopted something called the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction Treaty. It's also called the BBNJ. So on today's show, we'll explore what this treaty seeks to accomplish and what mechanisms are in place to protect ocean species and what are the most significant risks to biodiversity and areas where perhaps we should seek to strengthen the treaty. Our panel today is Elizabeth Mendenhall. She's associate professor in the Department of Marine Affairs at the University of Rhode Island. She's the author of Building a Regime Complex for Marine Plastic Pollution, as well as Nuclear Weapons Free Zones and the Issue of Maritime Transit in Latin America. And Rachel Tiller is a chief scientist at the SINTEF Ocean and the Department of Fisheries and New Biomarine Resources. SINTEF is the largest institute of its sort in Norway. And she's the director of Strategic Research Area of Biodiversity and Area Use. She's the author of Orchestration Within Plastics Governance, From Global to the Arctic, and So It Begins, the Adoption of the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction Treaty. Thank you both very, very much for joining us. Rachel, I'm going to turn to you first, since it's described as a mass extinction event. Just how significant are the challenges to biodiversity in oceans?
One of the main things to remember about the ocean is how little we know about the ocean. We do know about 80% of all life on Earth is in the ocean, but we don't really know how many species even exist there at all. We don't know where they're located. We don't know if they can be used for anything, if they should be used for anything. So that comes in at the same time as we're part of this biodiversity crisis, this lack of knowledge, this lack of understanding of how much is even out there and whether we should even be exploiting it. In addition to that, we have been trying to do this. I mean, it's not from a lack of good intentions that we are where we are today. It's mainly because the deadlines have been passing because we are not doing anything. So the SDGs, for example, the Sustainable Development Goals, one of their targets is target 14, and the target 4 and the goal 14. So goal 14 is basically life underwater. And target 4 is to end illegal and unreported and unregulated fishing, for example. That goal expired in 2020. So, I mean, somebody should be getting on to that at some point, but we're not getting on to it. Right. Same with subsidies to contribute to overcapacity, basically, and overfishing. So we're in the middle of this mass extinction event, not just in the ocean, but also on land. And it's driven by these things that we need and we want things. And it's been, at least for me, I can see us the past 10 years or so having gradually like shifting our views toward the ocean, because we're realizing that we're running out of resources on land and we have to try finding something else somewhere else. And then everyone's like, oh, but 70% of Earth is in the ocean. But there's, again, this so much uncertainty. And before we get this wild west out there where we just run wild and start digging up anything we can find out there, that's why the global community decided like, okay, let's stay ahead of the game and let's try to come up with something so that we don't run into these same kind of problems that we have closer to land. And let's come up with an agreement together so we can try to at least save this area where none of us are owners, or all of us.
The way you're describing it is that obviously we use resources in the ocean. I always like to point out to my students, the most popular form of protein around the world is seafood. Certainly, you know, that part of the ocean, and there's so many resources, including things like offshore drilling and the cultivation, you know, those resources. So is the real threat here the overuse of ocean resources and kind of a tragedy of the commons concern that, you know, if we don't manage this use, we're going to end up running out of it?
That obviously is it. And it's obviously also more difficult to do it in this kind of area. So you have, it's not that everybody in the world are going to start drilling for oil in the middle of the ocean, or go deep sea mining, or go try to find minerals around seamounts in the middle of the ocean, because very few countries in the world can do that. But the biodiversity of the ocean, it's primarily driven by some five really big things. And one of them is pollution, of course, based on all the traffic on the ocean. And then you have invasive species, new species that come into new areas. Climate change, huge driver of biodiversity loss. Right, so you have some really big ones. And some of the ones you also have is this change of area. The fact that we do change an area from being pristine to something that we are taking claim to, whether we're taking claim in putting aquaculture pens there, or if we're drilling for offshore oil. And then the final one is just using the ocean, you know, harvesting from the ocean, fishing primarily. So, I mean, these things are things that are driving in, and they all have one thing in common. It's us. we're the problem. It's us.
Beth Mendenhall, the oceans are governed. You know, we have a sense that we have this massive area that's not covered by sovereignty, but there actually is a pretty well-developed body of law about governing the oceans, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a common misconception that out in the middle of the ocean, there are no laws at all. There's one big international law, or really set of international laws that governs the ocean. It's called UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. It's just a big treaty, and it was negotiated in the 1970s and 80s, and it's often referred to as the Constitution for the Oceans. The main thing that it does is it creates all these different zones in the ocean. And essentially, the closer you are to the coastline, the more control a coastal country has. But out in the middle are the areas beyond national jurisdiction, where countries have to work together to solve problems like biodiversity loss. And that's what this new treaty, the BBNJ treaty, is focused on, is those areas beyond national jurisdiction.
By the way, the Conference on the Law of the Sea, it's the Constitution of the High Seas, but does it have universal acceptance? Do all the countries follow it?
It has 168 formal members that have ratified the treaty. I believe that's 167 states. States is the political science term we use to refer to countries, plus the European Union. There are some notable non-members, like the United States, Venezuela, Syria, et cetera. But most of the non-members of UNCLOS are landlocked states. So it has, I like to say, a pretty good subscription rate, pretty good buy-in by the international community. And that's important to understand, because sometimes when we're criticizing UNCLOS and the rules and laws that have kind of been added on to UNCLOS, we often get the response of, well, let's just do it again. Let's just replace it. And that's not going to happen. UNCLOS is deeply kind of embedded in the international community. And especially the zones that it creates that sort of divide the ocean between areas where coastal states have sovereign rights over resources, such as the exclusive economic zone is the first 200 nautical miles off the coast, and areas like the high seas beyond the exclusive economic zone that are shared international space.
By the way, that the EEZ, I know that's areas that you have the right to, you know, extract resources, as Rachel suggested. Does the law of the sea explicitly state, however, requirements to protect species from, you know, overuse or the potential for the species to be endangered or, in worst cases, extinct within the EEZ? So the country has to treat the exclusive economic zone like it's their sovereign territory?
Sort of. The thing to remember is that UNCLOS is a product of the 1970s. So it is relatively innovative in terms of environmental protection. In fact, it was the first international agreement that contains a general obligation to protect and preserve the marine environment. But when it comes to marine life, the exclusive economic zone, for example, coastal states have the sovereign right to control and manage living resources such as fish. They have to do that with an eye to the maximum sustainable yield. So it doesn't say sustainability, it says maximum sustainable yield. And that is a good representation of the general approach UNCLOS takes to marine life, that it sees marine life as stocks of resources, like fish stocks. And the goal behind UNCLOS is to protect those stocks or conserve those stocks so that they can be used. So more modern ideas like ecosystems have like an inherent value, or species should be protected, you know, so they can live their own lives, or even the concept of biodiversity, like thinking more broadly about the environment and the ecosystem and how they interact. Those are more modern ideas. The approach of UNCLOS is about conservation of stocks for future use.
Now, Rachel, we're back to your observation, which is we don't always know how large these populations are, and possibly even, I mean, there's so many still undiscovered species. So how much is the protection of biodiversity a bit of a technological problem, in that it's hard to declare that a species is rich and it's thriving if you don't exactly know how many of that species there are?
No, it's and this also will depend on who you talk to. Now, of course, I'm in a research institute where we have work on technological solutions to a better society. So I will be a techno-optimist and say that we're going to solve this through technology, and we're going to find ways to find out what is in the ocean so that we can protect the ocean, knowing though that this data can also be used for other purposes. So the main thing is right now is that this ocean is so vast, it's huge. We do not know what's out there. There are not enough research vessels in the world to try to figure out everything that's out there. So a lot of work is being done right now on using vessels that are already out there to help them monitor, help to try to find out a lot of things. And one of those things that they have found out a lot about is this thing called marine genetic resources, which is one of the themes that are playing into this new BBNJ treaty, this biodiversity in areas beyond national jurisdiction. And that comes in from having gone in and tried to discover new species and then coming up and trying to get some kind of DNA out of them, try to find new compounds in these little fishes or little creatures that they find at the bottom of the sea, to come up with new things that we really want, like cancer medication or skincare, things that could benefit us a lot, but that could have a lot of problems for the life that is down there at the bottom of the sea around these areas. So that's one of the things, right? With technology, we can't come up with new things that can be really beneficial to us, but might have really big consequences. And that's why they want us to have these things called environmental impact assessment. They want these marine protected areas. They want areas that we can, where we can actually try to find out ways to protect while at the same time exploiting these areas. So remember, this is not a treaty that is saying like, let's protect the entire ocean. It's a treaty, let's say, that's kind of like in the line with UNCLOS, right? I mean, it's about how we can still use the ocean for generations to come and not end it with ours, which we're on a route to do.
Yeah. And from a technological perspective, you focused on vessels, but as I was kind of following some of these negotiations, it seemed like there was an increased confidence in satellite technology as well. And so how much are these new technologies beyond ocean vessels creating at least some degree of optimism that something can be done for biodiversity protection out in the high seas?
Satellites are really exciting. And we do also work a lot on satellite technology, trying to find a way to use satellites in really what we work on is fisheries, try to find a way of monitoring both the fish and the vessels. Remember, we're usually in general not trying to manage the ocean. The ocean is managing just fine. We're trying to manage the people that are out there wanting to find a way of using the ocean. So that's really what these satellites can be best used for, trying to identify whether someone is breaking the rules. Is someone going in and harvesting fish in an area that has been set out as a marine protected area? So it's like, I mean, mainly, I would argue, be used as surveillance. mainly, I'm not sure how else we could use it that much, because it would have to have really, it would have to be really good to see much detail in terms of what kind of fish are there. Not, it wouldn't be able to, you'd have to have underwater cameras. Yeah.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing biodiversity in the high seas, this new treaty called Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction, or the BBNJ. And our guests today are Elizabeth Mendenhall of the University of Rhode Island and Rachel Tiller of the Research Institute SINTEF in Norway. Both of you have written on, and when you think of what's putting biodiversity so much at risk, are plastics. And so one thing that most people do know is there's a huge plastic garbage dump in the North Pacific. But first of all, how significant is this? And it's one of the real problems that Rachel says we're using the oceans. We're using it as a garbage dump.
It's very significant. And as Rachel emphasized, we know that problems like plastic pollution are problems, but there's still a lot of uncertainty in terms of the magnitude of the problem, the exact nature of the harms, and also chains of causation in terms of where the plastic came from, and then what happened, and then what happened, and then you have the effect on the ecosystem or a particular species or a particular fish stock. But I want to clarify that this treaty that we're talking about, the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction Treaty, it does a lot of great things, but there's a lot that it can't do. And plastic pollution is one of those things. We know that plastic gathers out in the areas beyond national jurisdiction in the high seas, but it comes from the land. And this treaty regulates activity that happens in the areas beyond national jurisdiction. So really the only parts that are relevant to plastic pollution are, number one, if you try to clean up the plastic out in the high seas, as some non-governmental organizations like the Ocean Cleanup are proposing to do, this treaty requires you to do an environmental impact assessment before you undertake a new activity, like cleaning up all that plastic, to determine like what ecosystem harms might result. Are you going to scoop up a bunch of creatures as well when you scoop up the plastic? So you basically would have to go through an assessment process before you could do that. The only other way that the BBNJ treaty is really relevant to plastic is that it creates a process for designating marine protected areas. And part of that process asks states to consider a whole list of things that are relevant to choosing which area to protect. And multiple types of environmental impact, whether it's, you know, climate change or marine pollution or overfishing, like there's lots of different things that you could consider when you're trying to figure out what area to protect. And plastic pollution might be one of those things. But this treaty, it's sort of restricted in how much it can do, because it can really only control directly activities that are happening beyond national jurisdiction.
I guess that's one of the huge challenges, Rachel, to any sort of environmental treaty, because the treaties have a kind of territorial jurisdiction. And it made me think, when you're discussing about fisheries, that under the law of the sea, of course, there's a management of how much a fish stock as they migrate. But there's one group out there that don't respect the EZ, and that's the fish themselves. And since there's been quite a bit of work on how we can expect to use kind of national models and territorial models, like our treaties tend to do, in a space like, you know, the global environment that doesn't recognize those boundaries. So I guess the question is, how much of a disjuncture is there with trying to enforce treaties that are based on some principle of territory in a world that could not be all that effective?
It's a huge challenge. And in terms of the BBNJ treaty, it gets even worse, because fisheries are not included in the BBNJ treaty, which is, it for some will sound just ludicrous, since that's the main activity in that area. But that's some really good lobbying going on there. So all the fisheries are out. So that's a really big deal, because right now what we're working with is something called regional fisheries management organizations. So these are, there's some 13, 14, 17, and all depends on who you ask, of different kinds of RFMOs, that we call them, regional fisheries management organizations. And what most of them have in common is that they don't work really well. They don't really protect the fish. So it's a really big challenge. You have the big tunas, for example. Who's going to come and inspect those vessels to find out if they're following those rules? Who's going to challenge them? Even if somebody goes out and challenges, this is international waters where nobody owns the area. So, and if you choose not to be part of that given RFMO, you're basically saying, well, turns out we don't believe in this. So it's a really big challenge. It's something we're going to have to want to do as people to protect the fish. And part of that is what I talked a little bit about this surveillance system and finding ways to monitor. Because generally, I'm from a fishing family. I'm from a really long history of fishers. Any fisher I ever talk to really want there to be fish tomorrow. They do not want everyone to go out and just grab all the fish that's out there. But there are some bad seeds. There's always going to be some, and they will fish a lot. So then you get this really bad, you do get the tragedy of the commons in some cases when they have these Olympic fisheries where basically it's like, go out and fish the quota by this date, and then everybody will go out and everyone will just grab as much as they can. So there's a lot of trials globally to come up with some solutions that people are going to want to follow. And so far, nothing's worked. So we'll see. We're hoping technology, again, will be one of the solutions. We'll see.
And of course, political will being one of the solutions. So whenever there's a new treaty, ultimately, political actors then have to decide what are the first steps in implementation? What are the areas that we really want to focus on that this treaty is meant to address? So for the BBNJ, what's kind of at the top of the agenda with respect to beginning to implement this new treaty?
The top of the agenda is getting to the start of the implementation phase, which we are not at yet. There's a powerful desire to pat ourselves on the back and declare victory. And it makes sense. You know, we want to celebrate progress as we go. But all we have done so far is conclude the negotiations. That was the adoption conference in June. And I think over 80 states now have signed the agreement. Signing a treaty is essentially symbolic. It conveys an intention to ratify the treaty. But we need 60 states to formally ratify this treaty before it does anything at all. After 60 states ratify the treaty, it will enter into force. And 1 year after that, the conference of the parties who have ratified, they will meet and they'll create up all these various institutions that the treaty establishes, like a scientific and technical body and an implementation and compliance committee. And at that point, states will start to implement the treaty by doing things like proposing a new marine protected area or engaging in environmental impact assessments. So in terms of like the top priority, it's getting states to ratify. Once they do, the top priority will almost certainly be designating a lot of marine protected areas, because we have this separate 30 by 30 goal that comes out of the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is more Rachel's area of expertise than mine. But we have this goal of by 2030, protecting 30% of areas in general, but in particular ocean space. And this BBNJ treaty will be pretty critical to meeting that goal.
And since ratification, you know, signature and ratification is this step, is the BBNJ, you know, part of the goal of that is this conversation. So people are talking about it and actually makes its way onto the agenda. But generally speaking, does it seem like there's quite a bit of international support for this? And are there any particularly significant holdouts that could make this a challenge to get to the ratifications?
That's a really hard thing to judge from my office here in Rhode Island, because I think that it's really easy to accidentally end up in a bit of an echo chamber. You know, we, Rachel and I are thinking about and talking to and interacting with lots of people who are very invested in the BBNJ, who have a lot of hope and who themselves are connecting with people in their countries that are excited about this treaty. But ultimately, it depends on domestic politics in all the various countries around the world. And that can involve things like re-election campaigns or the general feeling about international cooperation and international law. And so it actually doesn't matter who the first 60 states to ratify are. So that's a good thing because it means that the United States can't obstruct this from happening, even though our Congress is not really good at ratifying things lately. You just need 60 motivated, willing states. But they all have different domestic processes for ratification too, some of which take a while. I have heard the ambition is to achieve entry into force, so 60 ratifications by 2025. Historically, sometimes treaties take 10 years to get enough ratifications. This is an area Rachel and I have worked together a lot on the BBNJ treaty. She's the optimist. I'm the pessimist. So I'm the one telling people, hold on, we're not there yet. It's going to be really difficult to do. But I hope that I'm proven wrong.
Hey, ask me.
That was exactly what I was going to say. Is it's, I guess, best to lead with the pessimist and then conclude with the optimist, because I want to leave this conversation with some hope. So, Rachel, same question.
No, absolutely. And part of the reason is it's not because of the BBNJ treaty itself. As Beth says, we live and breathe it for so long, and we think it's the most important thing that's out there. But one of my colleagues said, this is the most important treaty that nobody knows anything about. But there's another treaty that everybody knows a lot about, and that is the Conventional Biological Treaty and the Global Biodiversity Framework. That came out blasting last year. So about a year ago, they signed this. And one of the big things, because they managed to do something not everyone can do, they managed to find like a little slogan and a logo. So they have this 30 by 30. So that's something people can remember. So it's protecting 30% of the ocean, or 30% of the world, ocean and land, restoring 30% and doing it by 2030, which means we're on a deadline. We need to move fast. And in order to be able to have any kind of chance of fulfilling that treaty and that framework, you have to protect global oceans as well, which means that these two are working hand in hand. And let's not forget also that these are the same people. These are the same states. These are not 196 different states. They're the same people that are going to the different, the same states at least, going to the different treaties. They know that they really need to fulfill this and they really want to. They came out loud at the CBD last year in Montreal when they signed it and cried and laughed and everyone is excited. And they do know that this is, as you said in the beginning here, we're at a point of no return. We actually have to make changes. So I absolutely believe it. I've heard the EU talking. They're 27 countries. That's half the ratifications. They just need to get this through. They also have a 2030 biodiversity framework. They also will protect 30% of the ocean. So I think once they get started, the rest of us are just going to keep following on really fast. The 1 year anniversary, the next COP for CBD is next year. They're supposed to have global plans ready. Every state are supposed to be there with their plans on how they will reach 30 by 30. They have to have BBNJ into it.
Our panel today has been Elizabeth Mendenhall. She's associate professor in the Department of Marine Affairs at the University of Rhode Island and the author of Building a Regime Complex for Marine Plastic Pollution and Nuclear Weapons Free Zones and the Issue of Maritime Transit in Latin America. And Rachel Tiller, she's a chief scientist at the research institute SINTEF in Norway, in SINTEF Ocean, Department of Fisheries and New Biomarine Resources, and the director in the research area of biodiversity and area use. She's the author of Orchestration Within Plastics Governance, From Global to Arctic, and So It Begins, the Adoption of the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction Treaty. Thank you both very, very much for joining us.
When we come back, harmful non-Indigenous animals and plants are costing the world hundreds of billions of dollars per year and exacerbating a mass extinction crisis. How and why is this happening? What are the potential solutions? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Invasive species cost $400 billion globally each year, and potentially over $1 trillion, which is more than the cost of all natural disasters each year. The alarming rate of the spread of these invasive species are threatening nature, food security, our economies, and human health. How can it be dealt with? University of Auckland professors Jacqueline Beggs and Al Glenn guide us through some ways their own countries have dealt with invasive species. Welcome to you both. I'm so glad you're here with us to talk about this really important issue. I thought the place we should start is really with understanding what we mean by invasive species and why it matters whether a species is in one geography or another. Al, would you like to start?
Sure. Often people confuse the terms introduced species and invasive species. And the key difference there is that invasive species are not only introduced to a place outside their natural range, but they're also harmful either to the environment or to human health or the economy.
Jacqueline, what would you add?
No, I think that's a great definition. There are all sorts of different languages you'll hear. People will say alien invasive species. So there's a wide range of terms. But I think Al's definition is great. So an invasive species, something that's spread out of its native range and causing harmful impact.
Yeah, and so what kind of harmful impacts are we talking about? Like, why does this really matter? Why is there this big report coming out of the United Nations saying we've got a crisis with invasive species?
Well, the impacts can be wide-ranging and significant. There can be a massive amount of economic impact, billions of dollars. There can be a huge amount of ecological impact, species going extinct, species being impacted in so many different ways. And so that's problematic when a lot of our biodiversity is already in big trouble. And then the third strand is, of course, social impact. And so there's all sorts of effects on human well-being.
Well, let's maybe break down some of those things, like you mentioned extinction. Like, how does that happen when there's an invasive species?
New Zealand has been extremely hard hit by extinctions. Over 50 New Zealand species of birds have already gone extinct, and there are dozens more species that are still threatened with extinction. And the major reason for a lot of those extinctions has been invasive species. In particular, because New Zealand was so geographically isolated, the wildlife here evolved without any mammals. So when humans arrived and brought mammals with them, that was an ecological disaster. The native bird species didn't have any of the sorts of defensive adaptations that would allow them to escape mammalian predators such as stoats and rats. And so they were just sitting ducks. So they were just very easily exterminated by these new natural enemies.
The natural birds that went extinct.
That's right, yeah. Yes.
So literally sitting ducks, we lost our duck species, many of our duck species. All sorts of wonderful native species have already gone extinct. But as Al says, the real risk, ongoing risk to many of our native species is that the long-term trends are not good for so many species. So I think there's around about 930 species in New Zealand that are classified as threatened, and many of those species have no active management at all.
Mm. Well, you know, you mentioned the need for multiple species for that term biodiversity, but not a lot of people understand why biodiversity is good. I mean, what is it about biodiversity that we need to protect?
Biodiversity underpins how our world operates. It's biodiversity that helps create soils, recycle nutrients, pollinate our crops, you know, so many ecosystem services that they provide, but also species have an inherent right to exist, you know.
Al, would you add anything to that?
It's a priceless and irreplaceable heritage. Once one of these species is lost, it's lost forever. We can never replace that. In some cases, that will have serious, tangible impacts for us. And in all cases, it's just a terribly sad thing to lose these incredible species. And one example that I think is quite poignant for Aotearoa and New Zealand is the huia, this fantastic bird with its striking big curved bill, gone forever. It's really sad.
You also mentioned a few other things before we started recording. One is you said things like fire ants that are invading have real consequences beyond, for example, what the mammals have done to the bird species.
Yeah, so insects is my specialty, and they're one of the groups of species that are still very much on the move around the globe because they're small, They're often cryptic and they hitchhike on human goods. It is really hard to have systems that keep these species out. So we're talking invasive wasps. We're talking all sorts of species of ants, mosquitoes. There's just, you know.
And the mosquitoes, we've read, are bringing all kinds of viruses with
them. Yeah, so the risk with many of these mosquito species to us is disease. So think dengue fever, think malaria. So it's still one of the global killers around the world. And so as these species move around, so do the diseases they transmit. And the same thing is happening for many of our crop species.
So any other that you can think of, Al, that we should be aware of? What are the invasive species most concerning? I know one of the others is Caulerpa. We talked about Caulerpa,
right,
which is actually globally a problem. What else are you finding that we're having to deal with either here or you're from Australia, right? Australia or elsewhere that you're studying?
That's right, yeah. So one of the most damaging invasive predators in Australia is the red fox. And
how did they get here? Or there,
foxes,
I guess,
were
to Australia.
Deliberately introduced to Australia by Europeans who wanted to pursue the traditional English aristocratic sport of fox hunting on horseback. So that was the reason, as frivolous as that sounds. And it's been an ecological catastrophe. So foxes have contributed to the extinction of more than 20 native mammal species in Australia. And there are many other species that will go extinct if we don't continue to control foxes there.
So the other big issue that the UN report talked about was how expensive it is to deal with the invasive species crisis. The number was something like $400 billion. Al, I heard you say that maybe that was an underestimate. Why are invasive species costing us?
The report itself said that 400 odd billion was a conservative estimate. I have read a previous estimate that put the figure at well over $1 trillion per annum. And to put that in perspective, that's about 5% of the global economy. So it's a staggering figure. And it was also estimated that amounted to more than the combined costs of all the natural disasters around the world each year. So you think of the costs of earthquakes, cyclones, tsunamis, wildfires, add them all together, and they still don't amount to as much economic cost as invasive species.
Well, I imagine that's partly because the invasive species are part of the natural, so-called natural. I think we should start calling them unnatural disasters, frankly. But for example, I understand that the reason the fires in Hawaii were so fast and so rapid and so devastating was because of an invasive species of grass that was highly flammable. Mm. I think similarly, the fires in Canada had an element of the invasive species that were highly flammable. So I imagine that that's part of the calculation.
Yeah. And I think it's a really important point that a lot of these drivers are interacting. So as climate warms and we're getting these more extreme weather events, if you add into the fact that you've made your forests more flammable with some of these invasive species, often they seem to be flammable species, then you've got the two things interacting and you go, oh my goodness, like where do you start with some of these things? So many of exotic species are highly flammable, the pines, the hakea.
And there's a vicious circle there with fire and invasive pines as well. Pine trees are very good at re-establishing very rapidly after wildfires, whereas a lot of the native vegetation will be destroyed and recover very slowly. Pine trees will sprout up very quickly after fire. So I've seen photographs of recently burnt areas where there's just a green carpet on the forest floor, which is all just tiny baby pine seedlings, and there's nothing else left. So after repeated cycles of fire, we end up with native vegetation communities just being completely replaced by a monoculture of pine trees. Mm-hmm.
And so let's think just a little bit about why is it important that certain geographies have certain species and other geographies not have them. Why is that important?
Well, I think it speaks to the unique character of each place. So I think there's huge cultural significance, but also talking as if all species are equal, but what's happening with many of these invasive species, it's the same suite of species that are invasive around the world. So sure, we could allow the world to become totally dominated by a handful of these species that do well virtually everywhere, but then we've just lost
the richness.
The richness, and just because those invasive species do really well in certain circumstances at the moment, you lose that diversity from the world. If conditions change in other ways, there's no coming back. The red imported fire ants that you mentioned before, that's one of the species that just seems to be expanding globally. And so some countries have spent masses of amounts of money. Australia spent millions of dollars trying to get rid of it when they first detected it in Brisbane, and they failed. They could not do it. We were lucky. So red imported fire ant has been detected here and established a number of times, but we caught those incursions really early on, and with really concerted work and some clever effort, we eradicated. We, as far as I know, we're the only place in the world have achieved that. So when I heard this week that red imported fire ants have been detected, established in Sicily, I go, unless they are right on to it,
yep,
we're going to have red imported fire ants throughout Europe, which increases our risk.
Oh, you know, that's right.
Every time these things spread to another locality, it just increases their ability to keep spreading further and further.
Anything you would add on that, Al?
So another reason that the loss of native species is so disastrous is that communities of plants and animals and all living things have evolved together in their particular regions of the world. And so there are interactions that occur between these species that prop up entire ecosystems. Obvious examples are things like plants that have specialist pollinators or specialist seed dispersers. And often, even if the pollinator or seed disperser doesn't become extinct, it might just become rare and just patchily distributed. So you have a serious loss of ecological function there.
You know, you mentioned earlier about the interaction of all the drivers, like climate and pollution and land use and all of these things. I'm wondering if, in fact, ecosystems themselves or the species within the ecosystems are going to have to move as a result of some of these anyway. So, for example, some species can no longer live in, for example, the Gulf of Mexico because the water is just too hot. So they're moving.
Yes.
And what does that mean overall for then those becoming potentially introduced, potentially invasive, and that interaction with climate and all of those matters?
Incredibly challenging to try and figure that out, because and many species around the world are on the move already. It's been documented for many, many, many species that they're having to shift into cooler climates, either by going north or south or by going up mountains or elsewhere. Some species can move relatively easy. Others, we've lost that habitat connectivity. Mm. So if you're a bird and you need to get further north and there's no habitat for you in between, well, bad luck. So there's all those issues. But yeah, everything's up in the air as to where it's all going to land, because what do we do with a species that can't shift on its own? Do we deliberately move it? And if we're going to do that, do we take all the things that it needs to form a community and interactions with it? And where are we moving it to? What happens to the species there?
Yeah. I know,
and
that's happening.
The risk that it could become an invasive species in the location translocate it to.
Yeah.
That's exactly kind of what I was getting at, was because I do know they are moving some species intentionally because they can't survive anymore in those environments where they had lived. I think there was a particular deer in the United States. They're talking about moving it because it can't survive anymore. But then does it become invasive to another habitat?
Yeah. So hopefully in those cases, they are doing their homework before they translocate these species. And we can, if we're careful, be pretty confident that an introduced species will not become harmful. And there are some good examples in New Zealand of species that have been deliberately introduced as biological control agents for weeds. One is the heather beetle and one is the ragwort flea beetle. Mm. Both of these have been successful weed control, biocontrol agents. But before they were brought here, there was very careful research carried out to ensure that these species weren't going to just start eating the native plants or competing with native invertebrates or having any other potentially harmful effect.
Yeah, I imagine the introduced honeybee has created problems for the indigenous New Zealand bees.
Yes, around the world there are issues around honeybees, but it's one of the trade-offs that humans get to make is like we value the honeybee for all sorts of other reasons, and so that's been traded off against potential impacts. When we start having to manipulate these things at the massive scale and speed with which we're going to have to act with some of these things, the sort of careful work that Al's been talking about that happens around bringing in biological control agents, I'm not sure that we're going to have time to do that for all these species.
Yeah, it takes years.
It takes years. And then what do you do if, say, we discover that we need to shift an iconic species somewhere else? And the answer is, yes, it will have an impact on the receiving. Do we then go, all right, we make the call that we're happy to live with that, or let the other species go extinct? You know, these are going to be tricky,
really hard questions.
Tricky questions.
Extremely hard questions. The term biosecurity, how is that different from biodiversity?
Biosecurity describes all the activities that we do in relation to trying to keep invasive species out and manage them if they do get in. It spans from pre-border to border to post-border to long-term management if things get away. So we use that term biosecurity. But interestingly, you know, there's a huge focus on it in New Zealand and Australia, but if you go to the other parts of the world and you start saying biosecurity, they think we're running around, I don't know, trying to keep.
No, that's right. But that's not because New Zealand are being paranoid. It's because we have a very different situation because we have been isolated for millions of years. There are so many species of plants and fungi and microorganisms that just don't exist here. And keeping them out is really important because they could cause catastrophic damage. Whereas in most other parts of the world, these things are already present. So there's no point trying to keep something out that's already there.
Mm. To some extent, although there are places like Hawaii, which would love more stringent biosecurity measures, but they are treated just as part of the mainland United States. And so they have new things arriving all the time. Their biota is equally as fragile as New Zealand. And they do not have the policies and regulations to try and stem that tide of things coming in. So our biosecurity colleagues in Hawaii are very envious of New Zealand's situation.
Well, that actually brings us to kind of how I'd like to conclude our conversation, which is about ways in which we can have interventions that are successful and what, A, New Zealand has been very successful in many ways, right? Are there lessons learned that could be exported to help others? But are there also lessons learned elsewhere that can be traded? What are the big interventions that you feel like we need here and abroad?
Well, I think the UN report really highlights that as one of the key messages coming out is that we have to hold hands globally and make this work, you know. And there's no need for every country to reinvent the wheel here. We have lots of, around the world, there are learnings. And if we can work together on this, well, we need to work together because the issue of globalization, but also, like, why wouldn't you build on what other people are doing? And this is used all the time in many places. We share new import standards with Australia for some species that go, okay, let's just make sure our regulations mesh together and make sense to the shipping companies so that we can reduce the risk of importing X, Y, Z. There's huge benefits to Australia and New Zealand of sharing that expertise with our neighbours, because if it establishes there, it's far more likely it's going to come here. And also they have other ways of thinking and doing which would help improve our practice as well.
Absolutely agree. And one of the other things that the new report emphasises is that preventing invasive species from arriving and establishing in the first place is far more cost-effective than dealing with them once they have arrived and become established.
Are these practices that other countries should be considering? The kind of heightened attention to visitors, shipments, and other related entrances.
Yes, and what to do when you get an incursion. I really hope that the Italians are looking very closely at red imported fire ants right now and going, how do we contain it? What are the learnings from Brisbane that didn't manage to eradicate versus New Zealand where they did versus other places, etc.? If we can focus in and stop some of these things spreading before they become widespread.
So what are the other kind of interventions that need to happen?
Well, in some cases, it is actually possible to eradicate invasive species. This is usually...
And is it desirable in some cases,
absolutely,
I imagine?
Absolutely. Yeah. Where it is feasible, it's desirable. And this is usually the case on islands because you have a relatively limited sized area and also, obviously, being an island, much reduced risk of reinvasion from outside. Mm-hmm. So you're not constantly trying to keep up with an influx of new invaders. And so New Zealand has led the world in this, and we've been successful in eradicating invasive species from many of our offshore islands around the country, which has really secured the existence of many of our native species. And anyone who's ever visited Tiri Tiri Matangi just off the Auckland coast will have seen the benefits there, where even before the ferry docks on the island, you can hear the bird song. And when you get off, you have birds just flying around your head in practically in swarms that you cannot see on the mainland. Species like Tieke saddleback, which are extinct on the mainland apart from in fenced eco-sanctuaries, are so common on Tiri Tiri Matangi that you'll see one every few moments. And it just gives you an idea of what can be achieved in the absence of invasive predators.
And I suppose, like with the invasive plants or flora, like if they would have eradicated the grass that was in Hawaii, they might not have had such a disruption. So that's another thing. But then how do you prevent that? I mean, it's not like you can actually, I don't know, maybe you can see when it's getting into the soil.
You mean the plant itself? Sure. Well, there's, I mean, we mostly talk animals because that's our area of expertise, but there's equivalent amount of work being done on plants, and there's all sorts of strategies for dealing with the plants. But again, it's the same thing in that once they've become widespread, they just about become intractable, and then you're talking about long-term management. So once things are really widespread in the landscape,
you just can't let them get established.
No, it's the early detection, which requires surveillance, reporting, and action. That's your main window of opportunity.
In one of your recent publications, Jacqueline, you talked about how important technology is now to do that surveillance. Is that already available, or is that something that is necessary to upgrade?
Yeah. Well, it's rapidly developing. And so there's a lot of focus on new molecular tools. And I think, you know, things like the global COVID pandemic showed the value of being able to use some of these new molecular tools. So, you know, the screening of wastewater so we could detect where it was coming in. Those sorts of approaches can equally be applied to other species that we're concerned about or getting in. So there is work all around the world looking at that sort of approach. But the other sort of technology that's rapidly increasing is machine learning and the ability for AI and these things to help us out. And so that's obviously a rapidly escalating field too. So we don't have to keep doing the same things in the same way that often are hugely labour intensive and difficult. I think we need to grasp these new technologies and look at how we can apply them to make things more cost effective and effective.
Al, anything on the mitigation side of it? Policies, other technologies? What's necessary now given the big gigantic crisis that the UN just told us we have?
We've been focusing just now mainly on sort of early detection and eradication, or better still, prevention. But in many cases, there are invasive species that have been present already for decades and they're widespread, where eradication is not a realistic option. But often there are still things that can be done, and those include containment, where we just prevent the species from becoming any more widespread than it already is, and also just managing invasive species in priority sites. So, for example, you might have an area where there are threatened native plants being outcompeted by an invasive weed. So you do weed control in those priority areas.
And then I imagine, like you mentioned, the island territory Matangi, that there are opportunities to restore like an entire ecosystem, maybe minus the ones that went extinct. But is there a lot of work going on in that area of like restoration of ecosystems?
Absolutely, yeah. Tiritiri Matangi is an excellent example. It was one of the first islands in New Zealand to have invasive species eradicated. It happened during the 80s and 90s. So there's been enough time now for the ecosystem to recover, and many native bird species were reintroduced there. But importantly, they also replanted the native vegetation. So before restoration occurred, the island had been a sheep station, and there was virtually no native vegetation left, just pasture grass. But now the island is, I think, roughly 80% native vegetation.
So it's an example of what could be really done on a global scale. I mean, minus the cities, but as Jacqueline and I have talked, we could actually integrate cities into ecosystems and connect them better.
Sure. And I think one of the keys to the success on Tiritiri Matangi was the involvement of community. Mm. Planting trees and restoring ecosystems is something that many, many people in New Zealand get involved with. And it's happening in cities, it's happening on farms, it's happening out on our islands and natural environments. And so
goals that were set by the United Nations, are they adequate and doable? Or do they need to up their game?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those goals are aspirational. It's probably a little bit like the climate change goals for emissions that we set ourselves. Do they actually mean anything unless there's concerted, genuine effort to make these things happen? And I think those are political decisions influenced by what we want as people. So engaging with our politicians to let them know what we want them to be investing time and effort into would be a good way to help nudge that all in the right direction.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much for this really important conversation.
Great. Thanks, Maria.
We're joined by two experts, University of Auckland Professor Jacqueline Beggs and Landcare Senior Researcher and Associate Professor Al Glenn, both leaders in ecology. And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.